Welcome to Open Source Underdogs, the podcast where we ask the founders of open source software companies the business questions you've always been wondering. My guest today, Matt Mullenweg, is the founder of Automattic, the company behind WordPress, the most widely used content management system in the world, and the platform of choice for this podcast. Matt, thank you for joining us today. Can you start by telling us a little bit about the history of Automattic and how it all got started?
I got started very much in a typical open source contributor path, where I was kind of reading blogs, got curious about blogging myself, started out with some proprietary software called MovableType, and then switched to an open source one called B2 Cafe Log. I became active in the forums for B2. And then as I started to learn to code a little bit, started contributing some code and creating some, there were no plugins at the time, but essentially hacks or extensions for B2. And then that parlayed into what became a fork of B2, because B2, the development was kind of abandoned. So at the time, there were probably four or five different forks of the code base. I started one called WordPress with a fellow who I had met through the forums and through my blog called Mike Little, who was in the United Kingdom at the time. And that was the one that took off. I'd had some experience kind of organizing groups, kind of local tech things in Houston before, like a Palm Pilot user group and running the computer club at my high school. So I kind of started just organizing people and bring them together. And WordPress became the most successful of the different forks of B2. A few years later, I moved to San Francisco to take a job. So I dropped out of University of Houston, where I was barely attending classes, and went to the San Francisco to work at CNET. And then once there, it became obvious that there were some bigger opportunities to start a company. And about a year later, founded Automattic.
What was the community like of WordPress at the time you started Automattic?
Small, but mighty. We had a very good and mixed group of kind of core contributors. The forums were pretty active. Things had really started to pick up, but it was only about 2 years old. So we were definitely very early in the adoption curve in terms of Press's market share. We weren't showing up as a percentage of all websites in the world yet or anything like that.
What was your idea for revenue streams when you first started the company?
It's actually not that far from where we ended up, although I used some different terminology at the time. So ringtones were kind of a big thing. So I was like, well, there's some equivalent of ringtones for blogs. That might be themes or things we could sell that are like little add-ons that allow people to customize. And then just the idea of cloud services. Like there were some things that were easier to do easier and more effective to do in a centralized fashion. Anti-spam being the first one that we actually created. I created an anti-spam service called Kismet. Actually still some of the code I'm most proud of, because over 10 years later, it's still running with over 5 nines of effectiveness. That was one of our first services that we created for WordPress users. And actually, we've always been somewhat agnostic in that Akismet was designed from the beginning to both work with WordPress, but work with other CMSs and platforms as well. At the time, that was a pragmatic decision because WordPress was very small. But I also consider it kind of a philosophical thing that there's room for lots of solutions in the market.
It seems like there's a number of related services that sort of build this larger organization. Is that accurate?
A little bit of the model was, even in the naming and the branding, was more like a Procter & Gamble. Or Berkshire Hathaway, or how Alphabet is structured now, were the inspirations for how we want to structure the company, is to be almost like a holding company for the various ideas, commercial services, and innovations, things that we want to see in the world. So even today, though WordPress.com is by far and away the biggest part of the Automattic's business, we still have a division we call Other Bets, kind of shamelessly copied from Alphabet, that does new and small stuff.
What do the customer segments of Automattic look like?
We're very much a subscriber-driven business. So our bread and butter is people paying somewhere between $50 and $300 per year for services for WordPress. That could be hosting on WordPress.com or add-ons through Jetpack or WooCommerce. WooCommerce is our e-commerce engine. Yeah, that's... You know, it's kind of nice because having such a broad user base, we're not overly dependent on a few clients. You know, being a subscription service, you can have very predictable revenue and growth metrics.
One of the challenges, I think, for a hosting business like that is it's hard to build really reliable infrastructure. And a lot of the times that requires economies of scale and a lot of capital. Was that sort of daunting when you initially got started?
Infrastructure has actually always been one of our key distinguishers from competitors. you know, being very frugal and scrappy early on, and also, of course, leveraging open source technology wherever and whenever we could, we were able to build systems that were resilient across data centers. And we have a very savvy systems team that's actually been able to scale that. So now, you know, running a bunch of the traffic across the whole web, we see well over 1 billion people per month. And with a team which is, you know, kind of in the 5 to 7 person range on the systems and network side.
So you're getting lots of operational leverage in running these services. It's pretty amazing.
Part of that's also that we don't rely too heavily on the cloud services like Amazon Web Services and others, because they tend to be very expensive. So we can get very good cost efficiencies by going a little closer to the metal and investing in networking and hardware. We're a subscriber-oriented business, so not being advertising-driven means that we're very privacy and user-centric, which has not always been the most popular thing, but I would say in today's day and age, many more consumers are beginning to appreciate that. Reliability and trust, you know, including with the WordPress broader open source community, there's a lot of fear when Automattic started that it would corrupt or slow down the open source side of things, because that's a fair fear, actually, because it often happens. But now, over 13 years, I think people have seen that Automattic and the open source side are actually highly complementary and they help each other a ton. So it's better together than it would be if either were on its own. And, you know, you mentioned reliability. You know, we try to architect our systems assuming pretty much everything is going to go wrong. So build in redundancy and robustness there wherever we can.
So in the interest of full disclosure, Glue is a WordPress user, and I don't know how we would operate the business without it. All of our public-facing sites are WordPress. And for us, one of the things that we felt about the platform was that there was this huge community of resources available who could help us with WordPress. It drove down the cost of the resources. Mm. And there was also a lot of like software, like you need a plugin for this or that, or this theme. It's like, it's probably out there already. But could you talk a little bit about the synergies of maybe how the open source has helped build the product and the impact, I guess, positive, negative, or challenging that it's had with the business?
First, I will take the opportunity to say that you should install Jetpack and get the Jetpack business subscription for all your WordPresses. It's very inexpensive. It's only $300 per year. And especially for business sites, it provides a layer of security, backups, and enhancements that'll get you more traffic and make your site faster. So all good things. It is one of our challenges that so few WordPress users actually subscribe to any Automattic services. So a lot of the value and revenue in the WordPress ecosystem goes to other folks in the ecosystem that don't necessarily contribute as much back to core. Automattic contributes a ton to core. And I would say the advantage of where we take an open source first approach is it makes things, it's often slower, so it takes longer, but the end output, the end outcome reflects a lot of feedback and a lot of input from every possible stakeholder. So you end up creating things that, you know, incorporate accessibility better or are localized into 40 or 50 languages from day one that really incorporate a lot of the use cases for people who extend WordPress and plugins and themes. And you get the agencies in there, you get the universities in there, you get feedback from kind of every possible sector and the wide uses that something that powers 31% of all websites gets. And just that cycle is much more rigorous than what might happen purely inside a company, even a larger company like Automattic, which is now about 800 people.
I was reading that the Automattic team is fairly distributed across the world. Can you talk a little bit about the advantages, disadvantages of the remote workforce and how that helped you build business?
If anyone's listening to this podcast, they probably are more likely to be amenable to distributed work, because that's how the vast majority of open source projects work. You know, so that's how we started that way. The original 4 or 5 folks were the people who I was already working with on a volunteer basis, you know, around the world working on WordPress. So that was, you know, the obvious folks to start the company with. As we grew, there was a lot of pushback against that, particularly from more traditional kind of Silicon Valley investors. We always remained agnostic and said, hey, we'll do this as long as it works. And if it stops working, we'll explore other things. And now, 800 people later, it's still working really well. And I don't see any reason to change. The biggest advantage, I would say, is that people are able to design their work and life integration in a way that going into an office and being physically co-located with everyone else that you work with every day just doesn't allow. So there's a flexibility that's kind of unmatched. And that includes being able to live and work anywhere in the world. That also, I think, opens you up to talent, super, super talented people that wouldn't be able to integrate kind of a normal 9-to-5 office workday with the life choices they've made. That could be caretaking for people who are younger or older or pets or something else that kind of might need to break up your day differently from the 9-to-5 workday. Or it could be living, you know, outside of a tech hub like Seattle or San Francisco for whatever reason. I'm actually based in Houston, Texas, and I love being there because my mom's there. And she's not too mobile these days. She doesn't really travel. If I'm not in Houston, I don't see her as much, and seeing her as much as possible is something that's very important to me. So being able to have my home base in Houston, but still contribute equally and be able to engage with the entire company as if we were all in the same building is just something that's unmatched by almost any other job.
How about partnerships? Were there other businesses or organizations that helped you along the way?
Oh, countless, you know. I think nothing really great gets created on your own. At the time when we started, it was pretty early days for distributed and open source businesses. But I definitely looked to MySQL, you know, Martin Mikos' leadership over there. And he's someone I've known probably since then, you know, so over a decade now. A lot of inspiration. I would say 37 Signals, which was David Heinmeier Hansen there, both doing Ruby on Rails, but also Basecamp and their other products. And they would write a lot about their process and how they built the company. You know, I read a ton of books as well. So like Seth Godin, Guy Kawasaki, Peter Drucker, who's, you know, a little more old school, but really useful. I do a ton of my learning from books. This year, I'll probably read 50 or 60 books. I used to do almost exclusively nonfiction and do more business books. Now I actually mix up quite a bit of fiction because I find I learn a lot from that as well. And it is enjoyable. So, you know, just from the beginning, I always love reading. I actually have on my desk at home, the Daily Drucker, which is almost like one of these calendar books. So every single day, it's a different quote from a different Peter Drucker book or article. And I try to make it part of my daily habit when I get started in the morning.
Has the channel been mostly people finding you on Google or finding the open source and looking for options? Or are there any other channels that you used in the beginning or now that have become important?
There's two sides of our business as well. We do have an enterprise side called VIP. So let me talk about the consumer side first. I would say from 2005 to 2016, so for about 11 years, it was all very organic, word of mouth, SEO, just normal channels. In 2016, we began to do marketing and advertising. And that has been actually pretty transformational for our business. I didn't like or believe in advertising before. So that was part of why we never did it. But really, I didn't understand it. And competitive pressures are, you know, the Wixes, Squarespaces, Weeblies, Shopifys of the world started investing hundreds of millions of dollars per year into advertising. And we began to see it have an effect in certain markets. So we're like, we better figure this out as well. And it's been really fantastic for the business. The enterprise side of our business, VIP, which is probably more in line with what Glue does, they're typically dealing with very large customers. They have a sales cycle and you kind of starts at 25 or 30 grand a year to use VIP and goes up to millions per year. They just have very normal kind of enterprise process. And a lot of the growth there comes from existing clients, both existing clients expanding their use of VIP, but also saying, hey, this is something that Facebook uses and, you know, the New York Post uses and all these other really impressive sites use. So let me check it out. VIP also comes in a lot through what I call the bottom of the pyramid. So it's not so much convincing a CTO or someone to adopt it, although that starts to happen more now. It's where often someone installs WordPress and asks for forgiveness, not permission. And it takes off like wildfire. And next thing you know, the higher ups are like, well, we've got like 50 WordPresses now and they're running half of our traffic. Let's figure out how to do this better. And that's often when they'll come to VIP.
Is VIP a hosted service or a support service?
It is both, but it's, I would say most people utilize the hosted version.
On the enterprise side, do you have any partners who help with integration and professional services?
We do. There's about a dozen what we call VIP agency partners that are essentially, you know, agencies. You know, they do much more client services and development. And it's not required to work with them, but most VIP clients do.
Is there sort of a line that you draw for what types of work maybe that you want to take on, or what types of work you want to refer to partners?
If it's more along the lines of consulting or development, we very much refer that out to partners. The Automatic's a tech company at the end of the day, and we're great at creating products and infrastructure and systems. But if, you know, we're not a client services organization by any stretch.
Was the competitive landscape daunting when you first got started?
You know, I love working on things for impact. And I would say the driver is really that I want the web to be open source. You know, I believe in open source. It's the most powerful idea I've been exposed to in my lifetime. And I've really dedicated my life to spreading open source. I realized pretty early on that most people don't care about open source as much as I do. So if I wanted the world to be open source, we'd need to just make better products. And you have to make better user experiences, build that better mousetrap. So it was very focusing, I would say, even from the first year or two, that if we wanted the web to be powered by a majority of open source, we would have to create the best user experience and the best software out there, because that's the only thing that would truly win.
Any advice for entrepreneurs who want to start open source software companies?
I'm probably not the best at articulating why open source is better, because I'm so deep in it. It's like so fundamental to my core being that it's hard for me to understand. You'd almost have to justify to me why you wouldn't be open source, because it's so obviously the future of technology. In terms of advice for entrepreneurs, I would say open source businesses actually aren't that different from normal businesses. And a mistake that we made that others can avoid is not incorporating the best leaders and kind of team members in functions like marketing and sales from the very beginning. You know, marketing is something we just started introducing in 2016. It's been huge for the business. We still really don't have any sales in the company, and it's something I'm thinking about now. You know, recruiting some really senior people in charge of revenue and sales to help develop that out. I expect it to be just as transformational for Automatic as incorporating marketing was. And my only regret is we didn't do it sooner.
Did the VCs think you were crazy when you said we don't have a team of salespeople?
Well, I think you can also look at it as a positive thing. It's completely possible to say, well, it's entirely self-service, and that is the bulk of our business. But I still think even if we don't become hugely sales-driven, having some senior leadership that really thinks with a sales mindset will make us be able to build all of our products better.
How do you interact with customers?
I would say support is a huge way that we stay connected to our customers. Anyone who joins Automatic, regardless of role, whether you're going to be the CFO or, you know, an office manager, you start with 3 weeks of customer-facing support. It's kind of your onboarding to the company. And then every team rotates back through doing that customer-facing support at least 1 week per year. I actually just did a week with my executive team about a month ago. And every time I go through it, we learn so much, and it becomes a really valuable tool for understanding where customers are and having that inform the roadmap.
Can anyone post on the support forums?
Not just forums. You get access to live chat, email. It's 24/7. You can talk to them in different languages. We invest quite a bit in our support function.
Does the immediacy of chat make it hard to manage?
No, I strongly prefer live chat to email. So we used to be pretty much exclusively email. And it's much more satisfying and faster, actually, to be able to resolve something on the spot with someone than have to do the kind of almost like playing chess by mail of shooting things back and forth, often with a latency of, even if it's minutes, but often hours or sometimes days between the messages. It's frustrating for everyone involved. So I would say that we're trying to move everything to live chat and away from issue-based.
So what's next for WordPress?
A big effort that we're doing right now in WordPress is a new editor called Gutenberg. It's probably the biggest change in WordPress in the past 10 years, and it's an effort I've been personally leading because it's so important. If we had done Gutenberg just on WordPress.com, you know, probably could have finished it in, call it 6 to 9 months. Doing it open source first and core first is ultimately going to take about a year longer. But what's going to come out the other end is going to be so much more powerful for the entire platform. It's 100% worth it.
Matt, thank you so much for sharing your insights. Anything you want to share before we sign off?
Well, I'll say that Automattic is hiring for almost every possible position all over the world. So if anything I've said resonates with you or someone you might know, please check out automattic.com, AUTOMATTIC, and check out our open roles. There's also lots of information about our creed, our philosophy. We try to publish a lot of what we do. And you can follow me at Photomat, Twitter mostly, but a little bit of Instagram. And then my blog is ma.tt.
All wise advice. Thank you, Matt, so much for sharing your thoughts.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, that's a wrap for season one. Next season, we have a great lineup, including the founders and CEOs of open source giants like Red Hat, Canonical, Redis, LifeRay, RocketChat, and many more. Transcription and episode audio can be found on opensourceunderdogs.com. Special thanks to the Linux Journal for co-sponsoring this podcast, to the All Things Open Conference for helping us publicize the launch, music from Broke for Free, Chris Zabriskie, and Lee Rosevier, production assistance from Natalie Lau, operational support from William Lau. Thanks to the staff of Automattic for scheduling support. Thanks to all of you for listening. If you like this podcast, please leave a review. If you're attending the All Things Open Conference, stop by the glue table to say hello. Until next season, happy open sourcing.